Spoilers?
Check.
Mature language?
Check.
Viewers beware?
Check.
Let Marvel superheroes have arrived! The Nerds in America!
Fantastic Four!
Hulk! Spider-Man!
Iron Man!
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Illegal Machine, and with me is...
Diablo Frank.
And...
Fix It.
And...
Guest star, Count Druncula.
Whoa. That was pretty cool. That went well.
That felt odd.
Today, we're going to talk about Marvel's Ant-Man, which was released on Thursday after 9 years of production.
That's about right, actually, isn't it?
Pretty close, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And we brought in the closest thing we had to an Ant-Man expert, Count Druncula. So, can you tell us who the fuck is Hank Pym?
Hank Pym was pretty much the second character created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in what is now considered the Marvel Age of Comics. He predates Spider-Man. He predates the Hulk. He debuted in an issue of Tales to Astonish about 2 months after Fantastic Four came out. But at the time, it was just kind of a conventional horror monster story. He created a shrinking formula. He shrunk down. He was in an anthill, and he had to be chased by comparatively giant ants. And that was it. After Thor came out, after Spider-Man and the Hulk, they decided to revisit the character because Spider-Man was such a success that Stan and Jack said, well, let's try another type of bug hero. They went back to the well, they found this Dr. Henry Pym character, and made him Ant-Man.
Holy shit, that was all professional and prepared and shit. We don't usually have that around here.
Hey man, you better stay in your lane, Dracula.
That's about the most expertise thing that I can get. The rest is just going to be off the hip.
He was the Ant-Man. He's the incredible Ant-Man.
Scott Lang stuff?
Did I ever read any?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first version of the Ant-Man that I discovered when I got into comics. The first time I saw or heard of Ant-Man was from, I think it was the 1992 series of Impel trading cards that Marvel released. And I got an Ant-Man card. It happened to be the Scott Lang version of Ant-Man. I just remember really liking the look of the character. Never having read him because I wasn't reading any other Avengers comics at the time in the early 90s. And that's kind of when I got into it. But something about the design of his costume and particularly the helmet. I always just really dug that helmet. Probably the first time I read about him was when he briefly joined the Fantastic Four in the earlier mid-90s, and there was an issue of Silver Surfer where he and The Thing and Human Torch teamed up with the Silver Surfer. I kind of knew about him from that, but I wasn't digging Fantastic Four or Silver Surfer at the time, so I couldn't follow him that way. But eventually, as I started getting into more of the essential, the back issues of the Avengers, I found him through that. I found him in the Michelini and Leighton run of Invincible Iron Man. I always liked him because I was more of a traditionalist and I prefer the most iconic heroes in their forms. I always thought that I liked the Hank Pym Ant-Man more just because he was the first. I wanted to be loyal to that. But the more I dug into their history, Hank Pym was just such a weird schizophrenic character. And Frank and I have talked about this a lot, but it seems like Hank's natural trajectory bounced between so many different heroic identities. First Ant-Man, then Giant Man, then Goliath, then Yellow Jacket, then just Dr. Henry Pym, because all they could do was put him in a lab coat to make him look rational. He just slowly crumbled psychologically to the point where no writer had a take on him that made him seem normal and level-headed, that they just embraced that and gave him this multiple personalities. And it all culminates when he actually backhands his wife, the slap heard around the comic world, and he's never been able to recover from that in terms of a creative standpoint. Because of the way that the characters are so intimately and intrinsically linked together with Hank and Janet, who is the Wasp, they can't be apart for very long. The writers and the artists always have to keep bringing them back together, and every time they do that, they have to force a reconciliation by the fact that Hank beat his wife, and she keeps going back to them, and that's problematic. Frank and I think we decided that he needed to go full villain, or they needed to kill him off 30 years ago, but they haven't done that.
I feel like I got Frank.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
Who drew the Impel card? Was that all Paul Ryan?
That card, I don't think, Paul Ryan didn't draw all of them, but that one might have been. I want to say that sounds right.
And was he still in the Bob Layton costume then?
It was basically the same as Hank Pym's original Ant-Man costume that he stole. So it was the same basic costume design.
I thought they jazzed it up some. They didn't make it any... Okay, so it was the same basic design then?
Yeah, it was the same color scheme, same pattern. I think just they might have made it a little bit sleeker. His first appearance in costume, John Byrne drew the cover. Yeah, I think it was the exact same costume that Kirby originally designed for him. They just made it look look less boxy and less weird like the Kirby design.
Well, I guess Pym wasn't in the costume for very long, so I don't remember the costume well enough to know how different the two were.
I think it's the exact same thing. I'm actually looking at the card right now, and it is Paul Ryan.
Illegal Machine has been reading old Avengers back issues. He went through the Englehart run and he's gone through the Shooter run. So what are your impressions?
Through the Englehart Shooter stuff that I've read so far, rereading after all this time, Hank Pym's a messed up dude. This guy just is a complete wreck in these issues. This is one of the many times you feel bad for Wasp. She's trying to do everything to get this guy's brain on the right wavelength and to make him not be a complete psycho. And he keeps having mental breakdowns and he doesn't know if he even wants to be a hero. He keeps saying he's not cut out for it. At one point, the dude just straight up snaps and the Avengers show up to the mansion and he's dressed up. This is when he's Yellow Jacket. He's dressed back up as Ant-Man and he just starts attacking all of them because he doesn't recognize who any of them are because he's had basically a mental breakdown and he's thinking that it's still, he just created the Avengers. So he's like, where's the Hulk at? Why does Iron Man look different? Captain America, what are you doing here? You were frozen 40 years ago, right? Or whatever, or 20 years ago. And he's literally fighting all the Avengers because the dude is just completely out of his mind. It's just a common thread through, I think I've gone back through almost 60 issues at this point, and the dude is never right through this entire time. And, that's at that point, that's years worth of comic books, and the guy's just a complete lunatic. And I haven't even gotten to, let me see, when did he smack Janet?
I thought it was during the Jim Shooter run, or should have been a Jim Shooter written issue.
I think so.
Okay, so I'm not even to that yet.
Was it Al Milgrom who drew the cover to that, or around that time period, wasn't he drawing the book?
Yeah, it might have been a Milgrom.
There's a Milgrom Easter egg in the movie, so it sounds like that would be a connection.
Yeah, his apartment complex is the Milgrom
Hotel.
He's just off, which I think is kind of a shame that he gets such a bad rap, because he's one of the more compelling, interesting characters in all these issues. If he was your favorite character, you'd be like, oh my god, this guy's a complete whack job, but he really spices up the book. You never know what this guy's going to do, and it's not in a good way. So I think in a lot of ways, Ant-Man gets a lot of shit for being just a really, he's Ant-Man, he talks to ants, what's the big deal? He's not a very good scientist, because all of his experiments go to crap, then none of them ever work outside the Pym particles. I don't know, I think there's just something kind of compelling about Hank Pym, especially rereading these issues, he's an interesting character. So I don't really remember where I was first introduced to Hank. Scott Lang, for sure, was the late Michelini Iron Man stuff. And in fact, there's a real good issue where Iron Man is incapacitated. I want to say it's after he overcharged his armor to deck the Hulk with one punch. So obviously he's overtaxed his armor and been paralyzed inside of it multiple times. So I may be crossing my issues here. But I think as he's out cold, the only way to restart the armor is to go inside and, flip a switch or whatever. So they get Scott Lang to shrink down and climb in through one of his boot jets. And the whole issue is about him kind of climbing through the Iron Man armor, which is pretty cool.
I want to say, and I could be misremembering it, but I think that might be, do they figure out each other's secret identities in that issue?
It's possible.
That might be the first time that they realize who each other is. Maybe I might be getting that wrong, but I thought that that's when Scott revealed that he was the new Ant-Man to Tony, and he also found out that Tony was Iron Man. Maybe that didn't happen. That could be a false memory.
All I know is they were gorgeous issues. That was primo Romita Jr. Leighton assimilation. Great looking stuff. Fantastic looking stuff.
When I came in, it was during the West Coast Avengers run where he was all suicidally depressed and he had to be saved by the evangelical hero Firebird. He was running around calling himself Dr. Pym. He even had his own logo, and I think he joined the team officially alongside Moon Knight. There's just a lot of bad associations there. But I can kind of see where you feel sympathy for the character, given that your favorite character is Iron Man and you lived through the entire Wizard area of drunk Iron Man jokes, painted black based on just one aspect, one moment in his career.
But it keeps him interesting. It really does. The poor dude just couldn't have anything right. At one point through that, I can't remember if it was a Shooter or an Englehart, but the dude is just trying to work in his lab just to release some steam, and all of his experiments are just failing, and he just loses it and starts smashing them to pieces. Well, and then you got all the weird stuff. He's Ultron's father, and then Ultron is trying to, he creates Jocasta, right? And he's trying to get Janet's brainwaves in Jocasta.
Explain Jocasta to me. I've never gotten Jocasta.
Well, Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's Bride of Frankenstein.
Did Ultron make Hank Pym create Jocasta?
He created Jocasta.
Ultron created Jocasta.
Right, but he needed Hank Pym. Ultron wasn't sophisticated enough to be able to pull the brain of Janet Van Dyne out and it, not brain, but you know what I mean, like essence.
The brainwaves, right? Or the
yeah.
Exactly. And put them into Jocasta. So he tricks Pym, because his brain is all over the place, into doing it for him. But there's Iron Man destroys the machine, so they think that it's failed, but really it's kind of, some of it is transferred. It goes on and on. But that's kind of how she got going.
Cool.
Now I'm not too aware she's joined the team yet.
Okay. Mr. Fix-It, what about you?
I read that Irredeemable Ant-Man, that's about it.
But have you ever read any stuff with Hank Pym or Scott Lang? I know you read Alias.
They are, but I've never read anything with them.
Yeah, you read Alias.
I did read the Perez run on Avengers. I think he might have made some appearances, but...
He was in that a lot for the first 2 years. But yeah, I think
I don't really remember pretty much.
He was in that run a lot, but he was either as Giant Man or Yellow Jacket. I don't think he didn't go back to Ant-Man.
Wait. Which Perez run? Buziak Perez?
Yeah.
Okay.
The second run.
Yeah.
The only Ant-Man I've ever experienced was the Irredeemable one. I enjoyed that story a lot, so for that little run.
You read Scott Lang in Alias, though. Didn't you read the Alias Omnibus?
I got through most of it. I haven't finished it.
You loaned it to me, and I finished it. Scott Lang turns up toward the end. I think they have a pregnancy scare with her, and he's in a relationship with Jessica Jones in that book.
I thought she only did anal.
Yeah.
Oh, well, hey, welcome to the Marvel Superheroes podcast, everybody.
You read Ultimates, right?
Yes, but in the Ultimates, he's kind of what? I mean, he's Giant Man. He's even in the Ultimate cartoons, they kind of portray him as a jerk.
He basically just slaps Janet that one time. And then for the whole rest of his career, he's the wife beater, even though it was that one slap, which I know these days in the internet, you know, outrage era, one slap is enough to paint you for the rest of your life. But in Ultimates, he really beat the hell out of Janet, though, right? Didn't he kill her?
That's where she starts dating Cap, and Cap protects her. Did they portray that like he beat her really bad? I can't remember.
I thought he tried to kill her with an army of ants or something.
He did.
Okay.
Not an Ultimates guy, don't know.
Fix it. I think you may have been the first of us to see the movie Ant-Man, because you texted me that at like 12 something that night telling me that you thought it was very, very good. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, no, I thought it was really well. I enjoyed it a whole lot. Michael Pena was, I think he was fantastic in it.
You went for the Michael Pena right off the bat?
Yeah, huh? I thought Michael Pena was hilarious.
He is like the first prominent Hispanic in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, isn't he?
Well, I did like the fact that Ant-Man had a group of minority friends. Like, it wasn't an all-white team. There was
criminals, so I don't know. They were all criminals, so I'm not really sure. You can't give him a lot of credit for making, hey, all of his minority friends were criminals.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still, I don't know, I walked in there thinking, like, I was kind of disappointed. The theater was only about half full, and so after all the previews, we're sitting there, it's getting started, and I want to say about 45 minutes into the movie, I was like, wow, this is a really, really good movie. I mean, I'm enjoying it. It's not as bad as I thought it'd be, so what did y'all think?
Well, I have seen it twice, so that should tell you something.
When did you see it the first time?
I saw it Thursday night.
How was your crowd?
It was about half full. Like you said, it wasn't a crowded house, but when I was leaving the next showing, there was a huge line, so might have been doing better. The first showing that I saw, I actually made the effort to go out of town and see it on an IMAX 3D, and I did not enjoy that experience. I don't know if it was the projector, I don't know if it was my glasses, I don't know if it was my seat, but it was a bad experience. Everything was blurry. I felt like I had an eyelash in my eye for half the time, which I didn't. So I knew, like, as soon as I walked out of there, I was like, I'm seeing this again tomorrow because I need to actually be able to see this and enjoy it completely. And I liked it better the second time on a small theater. And I have a lot of little nitpicky problems, but overall, I really liked it. I had a lot of fun with it. And this is something that I've come to, and I've explained elsewhere, that I'm incapable of judging these Marvel movies the way I judge other mainstream movies. The amount of fan service that I get from these films does a lot for me, which is why I liked Age of Ultron more than the first Avengers, even though objectively the first Avengers is a much better film. It's tighter, the script, the structure and everything, it makes a lot more sense. But I got more scenes that I've always wanted to see from Age of Ultron than I did from the first Avengers. And I would say that the same thing. I think the two best made, objectively, the two best made Marvel movies are the first Iron Man and Guardians of the Galaxy. But if I'm ranking my list of favorites, those movies are like 6 and 7 on my list. So, Ant-Man, it had a lot of problems. There were a lot of things that bothered me, things that I didn't like. But overall, it entertained the heck out of me. And because I'm a fan of the character, that carried a lot. And that made it overall very enjoyable for me. So I liked it.
Okay, Illegal Machine. Now, you and I saw it together, and we also saw it in 3D. What did you think of the 3D?
Actually, I thought the 3D was pretty good.
It's rare that I see a 3D movie that's as strong strong, potent a 3D movie throughout. It's like they didn't go cheap and like have the first 50 minutes be really strong 3D and then muted for most of the movie and then pull it back out at toward the end. Throughout the movie, he had some pretty solid 3D effects, I thought.
Well, even like when he was like walking down a street, they were loading it with 3D depth. And I was like, wow, really? They put a lot of effort into this. Do I really think it was necessary for the film? Probably not. But we saw it on a pretty nice, it wasn't an IMAX large, but it was one of the oversized screens. Had a good sound system. We had nice seats. It was like a 4:30 showing. So of course it wasn't busy, right? I mean, that was nowhere close to the showtime where they would be loaded. But okay. So let me just say straight off, anybody who's listening to the Marvel Superheroes podcast know that I thought this movie was going to less suck bad. Like, I didn't think a single trailer for this film portrayed it positively. They had nothing but sarcastic lines from Paul Rudd. They made sure they included a line, whether it was from Pym or Scott Lang, making fun of Ant-Man or, you know, making a joke. Yeah, I know it's Ant-Man. I didn't pick the name. Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So I just thought, I was like, is this going to be a make fun of the character fest, right? Some of the trailers also made it seem like it was going to be like a Judd Apatow, who I can't stand Judd Apatow. He's made like two good movies ever. I don't understand the appeal. I thought it was going to be a bad Judd Apatow action movie, which sounds like the worst movie ever created. And I don't like Paul Rudd.
I just want to say too, since you mentioned Apatow, interesting phenomenon. You noticed that there's a lot of stuff in the trailer that was not in the movie at all.
I'm getting to that.
And the same thing happens with Trainwreck. There's a ton of jokes that aren't even remotely in the movie. So it's just a weird thing that they're doing nowadays, it seems like.
And I don't like Paul Rudd either. I was like, he's just going to be sourpuss, sarcastic, the whole movie, right? And then we go see it, and I left there thinking, whoever the hell put those trailers together should lose their job, because I didn't think that his main sidekick guys, what's his name again?
Michael Pena. I don't know the character's name, but the actor is Michael Pena. Luis?
Is it Luis?
Luis was the character.
I thought that when they tried to kind of spice him into some of the trailers at the end, I'm like, okay, so now is it like campy funny? What is this movie even going to be like? Because the first several trailers didn't have him in it at all. So you had no idea that he was going to kind of be there to play off of. And really, I felt they picked some of his worst scenes for the trailers. So I just it boggles my mind how bad those trailers were, because I thought the movie was pretty damn good. I did go in with very tempered expectations, but this might be my favorite Paul Rudd movie. I thought he was terrific. And I don't think there was he had his self-deprecating moments, but I thought they were all effective. I truly I loved his daughter. His interaction with his daughter was all great. I thought Janet was who played Janet again? I'm sorry.
Evangeline Lilly.
I absolutely loved her. I thought she was terrific. I thought Michael Douglas's Hank Pym was fantastic. The only dude who got on my nerves was Cross, the main villain. I know you're supposed to hate the lead villain. I didn't even like seeing that guy's face on my screen. And the way it was shot, everyone was really big. You know what I mean? That they seem to always be right in the camera. And I was just seeing more of his big dumb face. And I wanted him to just get off the screen. And it wasn't because I hated him, because he was such a mean dude. There was just something about him that was grating on me throughout the movie, and I just didn't like him. But other than that, I thought the movie was great. I thought the effects were great. I thought all the shrunken scenes, which I know I made the joke in another podcast about how people like shrunken stuff, and I don't get it. I liked it. Whenever he would shrink down and he was running through carpet, or they're following him down through the ant hill, or when he's floating on the ants going through the pressure pipe after they've dropped the water pressure down, I thought that was all just awesome stuff, and they got really creative with it. And I'd kind of read beforehand that they were trying to, progress his world. They were trying to make his world different, like trying to put things in movies you hadn't seen before. And they did, the way they got creative using the different types of ants. I just thought it was all super clever. And I just there's nothing really I can gripe about with this movie. I thought it was good. I'd watch it again. And that's it. That's all I got.
How about Mr. Fix-It? You didn't talk too much about the movie. Do you want to elaborate some more on some of the characters and scenario?
I thought Michael Douglas was great as Dr. Pym. The villain, he felt forced. They never really gave. I mean, I get that he was trying to get Dr. Pym's approval, and he kind of went psycho, and then it hinted that his particles were affecting his brain. And I got it when we did that little lamb part. They kept liquefying the lambs. I heard people squirm in their seats, which I thought was pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I thought it was cool, but that was kind of tough to watch. Like they let the lamb probably let the lamb scream probably because a lamb scream is pretty visceral, right? They probably had him scream two or three times too many. Like it's like, okay, we get it. We get that there's a living lamb there. You're about to melt.
When he saw that, and then he's like, "Rated subject 46." I'm like, "Holy shit, he's gonna do it again!" And people, I gotta agree with Matt though. I mean, it was just a really fun movie. I would put it up with Guardians type of fun, where you walk in, you're not sure what to expect, and the dialogue's good. The story had a nice pace to it. Never once did I get bored, or like, you know, I never got bored watching him shrink or do all that stuff. I like all the little montages. I thought those were funny. So I'll definitely see it again.
I thought the way that they weaved in his daughter's father-in-law, I thought they did a really great job of weaving him in, like especially towards the end when he showed up to confront Pym. Like, it made sense because they'd seen that his lawyer was Pym. Like, this, nothing seemed forced to me that, oh, he just happens to show up. And they made sure that Home Dude had honked the horn earlier in the movie, so when the horn gets accidentally blown later on, you know what I mean? Like, I thought they did a real good job. I don't know what it was.
I almost shedded a tear for Anthony when he passed on. That was a touching moment.
Wind floating away. I thought Anthony was going to come back. I thought it was going to be a fake death.
Well, you remember I leaned to you, got up against you during that and said they're going to kill Anthony, and I knew that because they kept saying his name over and over again to make sure that you identified that one specific ant, just so that when they killed it off, he'd feel a little bit of a punch. I knew that shit was coming.
In the ant world, he was the red shirt.
Yeah. He was the Star Trek red shirt. And
he was the red shirt, all the ants. Okay.
Frank, I just want to make sure you're pronounced. It's Ant-thony.
Yeah.
No, there's no H. It's Anthony.
Oh, Anthony. Anthony.
It's more Italian. It's Anthony.
Got it.
Unless this is jumping ahead, what did you guys think of the inclusion of Falcon and the fight between Ant-Man and Falcon?
I thought it was great because Falcon sucks. So if he's going to be any Avenger, it's definitely going to be Falcon.
Well, I do like that little line. He says, you know, whatever, you know, don't let Cap know what just happened. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, because he should be embarrassed.
Yeah.
I thought that was really bold. I did not see them having such a big presence. I mean, they referenced the Avengers movies a lot in this movie. They made
dropping the city and all those lines.
You're right. They didn't just mention the Avengers. They actually referenced specific details from Age of Ultron, which I thought was really, that takes some cojones to do that, right? I mean,
and I like that you have the new Avengers compound, and clearly they don't know that this thing is out there yet. And so I like that surprise. That was a nice touch. But at the same time, it bothered me that they made a point of having Ant-Man beat one of the Avengers. And of course, it's going to be a lesser Avenger, and of course, it's going to be a Black Avenger.
God, here I go.
No, totally. That bothered me. It's like the Falcon was the expendable one, and in service to Ant-Man.
I think that fight was done in a way that neither of them looked bad. Like, Falcon didn't look bad for losing that fight, I don't think. I think it showed them both using their technology and their power sets creatively. Somebody had to win, and it's Ant-Man's movie, so it's going to be Ant-Man.
He didn't really win. He just knocked him out in rain.
I don't think Falcon looked like he got jobbed in that one, or like he was pwned or something like that. I thought it was a fight he wasn't expecting, he wasn't ready for, and Ant-Man exploited a flaw in the suit's design, the jetpack's design. So,
well, I mean, I don't understand what the big deal is. Falcon is the shittiest Avenger, and he got beat. Well, I don't understand why this is a big deal.
I like Falcon.
I don't.
That's fine. But power-wise, Falcon is... Let's say we had some trading cards here, and on the back of the trading cards, it had list statistics. Falcon would have the shittiest statistics of every single Avenger. Therefore, he gonna get beat.
Well, yeah, agreed. I agree with that. Yeah.
Well, thank you. So now we're on the same page.
Well, I got a quick question, though. Now, when they were showing Dr. Pym in the Ant-Man suit, and he's jumping around fighting soldiers, like, what war were they hinting at that he took place in? Because they kind of did like black and white footage.
Grenada, clearly.
Wasn't it?
Oh, clearly Grenada.
Okay.
No, the good thing is, okay, this was 80... this
I was thinking like Vietnam or something, but...
It might have been, because this was 89, and he's still shown as being pretty near to middle-aged at that point in time. Yeah. So I think, logically, it would probably be Vietnam, but as much as they're still keying into key events, they're still wanting to have that ability to time shift, and it's probably better for them to not specifically name a particular war, because some wars are ickier than others, so... I guess.
Well, and it's also probably, I mean, if you're talking about the earlier mid-80s, you're talking about the Cold War or 70s, 60s, the entire era. And it's probably, it might not have been an established conflict. He might have been sent in there to assassinate somebody or retrieve a kidnapping victim or something like that.
Well, yeah, it was so, the Russians that sent the ICBM at us that he and Janet have to fight, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
It was terror. It was a separatist cell in Kursk. Yeah. So yeah, it wasn't officially Russians. It was Russian separatists. But yeah.
And can I just go ahead and say that is my favorite part of the movie. I loved that bit of world building. I loved that they CGI'd a younger middle-aged Michael Douglas into there. I love that Peggy Carter was there as one of the early SHIELD agents and one of the most important at that point in time. I loved that they got John Slattery back in there in full Roger Sterling Mad Men mode. I loved that whole sequence. I loved all that. And I loved that they firmly established that Ant-Man was active before most of the current Avengers, and so was the Wasp, more importantly to me. I thought that was excellent. I love that.
The de-aging effect on Michael Douglas in that opening scene was almost as impressive as any of the shrinking technology that they showed later on.
More.
It was jaw-dropping. It was jaw-dropping. Yeah. Like, when he walked out, we were like, holy shit.
I was like, that's close to Gordon Gekko, like, era. I was like, that's not that bad. That's a pretty good aging effect. So, yeah, that was impressive.
And I have to say, too, that I think Michael Douglas was probably my favorite performer in the movie. He was one of the biggest stars of the 90s, but by the end of the 90s, I was really tired of the guy. But it's been so long since I've seen him on the screen, and he has such presence in this movie.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say.
I really enjoyed him.
Yeah,
and go ahead.
I just want to say, we briefly touched on, Hank Pym's comic book history in this, and I love that they didn't try to ignore it. Like, they let you know Hank Pym is a hothead. He does not have his shit together all the time. One of my favorite lines in the movie was when Cross was talking to him and said, why did you push me away? Or whatever the line, what was the line? Like,
what did you see in me all those years ago?
That's right. He says, what did you see in me? And he said, I saw too much of myself, which is perfect because the guy's a lunatic. And Hank Pym's like, holy crap. He knows he's a lunatic too.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
Can't wear the Ant-Man suit because it took a toll. I love those little pregnant bits of dialogue where they don't come right and tell you that shit happened. But if you're a comic fan, you're like, oh, okay, that shit still happened.
Yep, absolutely. I love they left that in there. Again, that's what I'm saying. So you're saying his character had depth. He didn't just play miscellaneous mentor. You know what I mean? Like, I felt for the dude. I don't know. I just thought, you're right. He had a fantastic performance. He was great.
And the movie had the benefit of really writing in a Hank Pym that doesn't exist in the comics and therefore isn't burdened by all of the baggage that would be crippling from the comics. I mean, you're right. He pointed out that this did tease some of Hank Pym's characteristics and some of his ability to kind of flip out and lose edge, like how he does have some temper issues and he does have some eccentricities and he is more obsessed with his work than with his interpersonal relationships. But really, other than that, I mean, that could describe half the characters in the Marvel Universe. So by making a much more older character, they really had a lot of leeway where they could have named this guy anybody. He didn't have to be named Hank Pym, and I don't think many people would have noticed because, again, the Hank Pym, the character from the comics, is a mess. So they were able to cherry-pick the best parts of the character and create something that was really brand new.
One thing I want to say, too, about these moments is that I was a hardcore DC fan for 20-odd years. And the reason why I love DC Comics in the post-crisis era was because of that sense of history, that certain things happened at certain points in time. You had legacy, you had generations of heroes, and changes would happen across time. And that's something that makes me hate DC Comics now because they've completely lost that. And part of what draws me into the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that they're building that up better, I think, even than the actual Marvel Universe in showing, look, we have a history. It goes back to at least the 1940s. And I'm pretty sure at some point they're going to go back, you know, further back in time than that. But you see these generations. You see that these people are existing in these specific points in time. The X-Men movies have been great about that, too. I'm really looking forward to X-Men Apocalypse because I want to see X-Men in the 1980s. I want to see the 80s. You know, I think this could be badass.
Even with the goofy looking Apocalypse.
You know, here's the thing. I know
set in the 1980s, starring all of your favorite characters from the 90s.
Yeah. But I'm glad that they're willing to embrace, both Fox and Marvel Studios, they're willing to embrace that some of this stuff happened in the past, that you can enjoy that period flavor without necessarily screwing up your history. You won't distance people just by having things set in a certain point in time. And in fact, I think it can draw you in more, especially if you have nostalgia. I'm going to enjoy that movie almost as much as any of them, if not more than any of them, if for no other reason than because it's set in the 80s and I have such nostalgia for that period.
Hey, I do want to say about that movie, though, Apocalypse is going to be so bad, it's going to make Thanos look that much better.
Yes,
we're going to be all...
This is like that Apocalypse heat, like bulks up at the end of the movie or some shit.
No, that's not going to happen.
Trekker Talk, a fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous backstreets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Whose movie was this? Was this Scott Lang's movie or was it Hank Pym's movie?
I think it was Ant-Man's movie.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Ant-Man. Whoever had the costume on.
How you like my cop-out?
I'm going to go with...
I still want to know what Frank thought of the movie.
What's
he
that?
He kind of skated it quite a bit. I still want to know what you thought about the movie, Frank. I've heard you compliment it several times.
I know what Frank's biggest problem with the movie is. I bet I can guess. And it's probably my biggest problem, too.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that. I just want to answer your question first, though. I think it's the Pym's movie. Because not only is the best character in the movie Hank Pym,
like Pym's cup,
right, there you go, but also they do so much of this movie to set up Hope Van Dyne and the heroic legacy of the Wasp concept, that I think that ultimately I think that those two characters will have more of an impact on the Marvel Cinematic Universe than the Scott Lang Ant-Man will.
Hey, I'm gonna give an opinion, you want to hear?
Go for it.
Check out this opinion. I think Hope Van Dyne is already my favorite Marvel Cinematic Universe female character, and it's not even close. Sorry, don't care about Scarlet Witch. Scarlet Witch doesn't have like 1/1000th of the depth that Hope Van Dyne already has. Forget Black Widow. Scarlett Johansson, not that great an actor. Don't particularly care for her power set. She can never be as powerful as any of these other characters just because all she does is do that move where she jumps on the top of your head and spins around. That's her move. That's all she's got. And then, obviously, Ms. Marvel is not out yet. Like you said, you didn't care for Gamora. She sucked. So I am all about Hope Van Dyne. That chick, she's a kick-ass. She's got attitude. She's got snark. She's smoking hot. She's got Janet Van Dyne's exact haircut from the comic books. I absolutely loved everything about that chick. I loved how much she wanted to get in there and rumble more than anybody else. The entire movie was about her wanting to go in and rumble, and Hank not letting her, even more than Scott. Even Scott's like, hey, maybe you should let her go. Like, she knows exactly what she's doing. She infiltrated all those dudes. She was the only reason this plan really worked. She was awesome. She was kick-ass. Period.
I agree with that, and I'm also really, really frustrated by that, because they established so quickly that she is the right person for this job. She is better qualified in every way than Scott to do this superheroing thing, and her father wouldn't let her, and it's the source of the conflict, and it is great, and I liked all of the scenes when it showed how frustrated they were with each other when she had to walk out of the room, and when he eventually revealed what happened to her mother, which was good. It was a powerful scene. I think it was strangely timed because he wasn't really like prodded into revealing that information. I also think that's a story that he could have told her 20 years ago. But all that aside, my big problem was, it felt to me like this was Hank's movie, and Hank needed to get to the point where he could let her make that choice, where he could give her the suit, essentially, and say, I've been keeping this from you your whole life, and I can't do that. I have to allow you. And they do that in the mid-credits stinger, no pun intended, but I think that should have been in Act 3. I really wanted, when they're getting out of the lab and he's injured, I wanted him to basically just whisper to her, there's another suit. Get back to the house, put it on, and save the day. day, and I wanted her to become Wasp in this movie because I felt like that was the culmination of their arc, the two of them together, Hank and Janet and Hope. And it felt like we just got to the tipping point of that story arc, and they're saving that. And what ticks me off is she's not going to be in Civil War because she's like super pregnant. They had their red carpet premiere while they're filming Civil War, and she's in her mid third trimester. So she's clearly not going to be in Civil War. So the earliest we can see her suit up, probably going to be Infinity War.
Man, these fucking Marvel actresses are just putting the screws to feminism. They keep getting pregnant and destroying a bunch of arguments in favor of equality. What the fuck?
And really, the people who suffer is us.
Yes, we're the ones who suffer. White men. And Mr. Fix-It.
Yeah, that was my big problem. And I have a feeling that Frank probably has a problem with the Wasp too. So,
you know, here's the problem that I don't think that you can have Wasp in this movie because I do think she would outshine Scott. And this is the Ant-Man's movie. I think he needs to have at least his one movie. I really don't see this being a franchise. I don't see them sequelizing this one. I think they're setting up his character. I think this movie will do decent, but it's not going to blow the doors off anybody. And they're just going to let him be like the Hulk, a guy who appears in other people's movies. Where Wasp has potential, I want to see that potential realized in other movies. But if she shows up in this movie, then Ant-Man doesn't even gets his own movie hijacked. And I don't think that's fair. What about you, Fix-It?
What
do you think about the Wasp or Hope Van Dyne?
I think she's going to be cool in the Avengers movie.
Also, about the hair, I think it looked like an old lady's mink stole had burrowed through her brain and was just sort of like dangling there on both sides of her head. She looked like Orange Cat had downgraded to a lime. So that was the worst fucking wig. It was distracting to me. So
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I didn't even like short hair. I thought it was fantastic. That's exactly what Janet Van Dyne looks like. Oh,
yeah,
it was great.
But that's the thing,
awesome.
Though, is Hope is clearly not Janet, though. And she didn't have, like, in terms of her personality,
no,
she's
wrong.
Really?
No, you're wrong. She's totally Janet Van Dyne.
You mean the Roger Stern one that you cut your teeth on, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's the ass-kicking Janet Van Dyne.
So she's not the dilettante, the debutante, the kind of rich, flighty person that I've read in a bunch of other comics.
She is. No, she even does that then, but she always wore the pants with her and Hank. She always wore the pants.
That is true. I could see that. That was actually, I think, one of the problems is that he knew that she was top in that relationship, and just like with every other relationship he had with the other Avengers, he was always the subservient one, the smaller one, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, Janet was the one who liked having fun. Like, she was the one who was always basically dragging him into the adventure, in part because it was the right thing to do, and in part because she was a thrill seeker, and that was interesting for her character. And at a time, she was also very flaky and very flighty too, and was so consumed by his looks and by the men's looks because of the time that she was being written. But Wasp was fun. More than just another Marvel leading lady, what this universe needs is somebody who's really enjoying it, to the extent that Tony Stark and Chris Pratt are enjoying their, you know, superhero selves. We need a lady who can bring that sense of fun.
Well, and actually that's part of why I didn't like Thor after the first movie, is because he got to be such a sourpuss and so serious. It would be fun to have someone who's really has a zest for the adventure again. One thing I want to talk about, though, is I did not like either of her relationships. Was she in a relationship with Darren Cross or not? I don't understand what the relationship was. Were they friends? Were they associates? They don't seem to be romantic, but then they kind of do. What the fuck was going on there?
I think that's what it was. I think it was, we don't know what the fuck is going on here. I think that she was wanting to stay kind of close-ish to him. I think they sort of had that in common, that they were both pushed away pupils of Hank Pym, right? Because he kept saying, oh, he found another way to lock us out, and he's found another way to do this, and he found, you know what I mean? Like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that there was, but I think that she sort of kept it close because she needed to stay close to him in the company, just in case he ever finally solved the Pym particle deal.
So like pseudo-sibling close associates, is that where we're at here?
Right, and I think that she led him on.
Okay. And then
to stay close.
And I didn't really feel it with her and Scott either. I mean, I know they did the whole kiss thing at the end, but
that was horrible. That I hated that moment. And I think that felt to me like a studio executive literally standing over their shoulder and saying, we need a kiss between the two leads at the end of the movie. And then the writers and the director doing everything in their power to make fun of it after the fact. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty forced.
And getting back to your other point, it wouldn't surprise me if there's about 10 minutes worth of Darren Cross scenes that got cut from this movie, just for the sake of time, because I don't think his development was coherent at all. Like, he starts off already crazy. He kills a guy in his second scene.
Yeah.
And they wait until the very end to say the particles in the suit they're interfering with your mind. Well, we haven't seen him put on the suit. We haven't seen him be exposed to the particles up to that point. So there's got to be a lot more with him that was just left on the cutting room floor.
That's fine. leave it on the floor.
Like, yeah, I don't know. I didn't like him either. I think he's one of the worst of the Marvel villains. He just, like you said, he came out of the gate too nutty and too transparently evil and just kind of flat. So I'm not going to miss him.
Well, and then I think they kind of overdid even when he finally successfully shrank that one sheep, and then he like flicks the thing that it's in and it smashes around on the inside. Like, they just went too far. Like, he was too psycho, like in bad taste psycho for the film. I don't know. Luckily, I don't know. I forget he was even in the film. It doesn't even bother me. And then he fought a baddie at the end of the film. That's fine. To me, it didn't detract from the movie at all. It would have made it maybe even better if he was a really good villain. But for me, the movie was about Hank, Scott, Hope, and his kooky minority friends that happen to be criminals. Except for the Russian guy. That dude got on my nerves because he was a really bad accent. But the rest of the dudes I thought were really good.
See, I felt like there were too many. I felt like the three supporting criminal players could have been one or two guys.
Right.
Michael Peña, the Luis character was funny most of the time. There were a few times where I thought it kind of fell flat, but most of the times when he was on, he was really solid. I thought T.I. and the other guy, David Dasmalchian, those parts were bigger than they needed to be. I also thought Bobby Cannavale, who played the Paxton, Scott's ex-wife's new fiance, the cop. I really like that actor, and I would love to see him in a comic book movie like this, and I thought he was wasted in this one. I didn't think that part needed to be that big. It was cool seeing him run into the house to protect his new daughter at the end, but I also would have liked to see Judy Greer do that, because you've got an actress with her talent, and she has nothing to do in this entire movie.
She was super wasted in this movie. I'm a big fan of Judy Greer. I was watching...
Which is the exact same thing in Jurassic World. She was in the other biggest movie of the year, and she had nothing to do in that movie.
Yeah, it bothered me how much she wasn't in the movie, given that she's the mother of the child and the ex-wife and everything else. But Bobby Cannavale, it was funny because the first time I saw him was in The Station Agent with my man crush, the Dink. I've enjoyed him since then, but I think the main thing that I've watched that I liked him was my girlfriend made me watch Will and Grace, and he played Will's incompetent cop boyfriend, and it felt like a continuation of that role here, because he was a really not good cop throughout this movie, and he brought a lot of the slapstick material. And my understanding too is a lot of the scenes with him and Judy Greer were like improv'd, and I don't think that worked very well, because I did not particularly like those characters. I like the actors, I wanted to like them in this movie, but I didn't think any of the scenes with those characters worked very well.
If you haven't, he's in the third season of Boardwalk Empire, and he's phenomenal. He's crazy. He's dangerous. He's scary. He's really, really good in that. But when I was seeing him, I was like, oh, I like this actor. I like the presence that he brings. I like Judy Greer too. But I was like, if you took them out of this movie, what are you missing? Not a whole lot. And that's a problem. So I felt like the supporting cast was maybe too big. They could have reined some things in and maybe spent more time on the villain or on, you know, the relationship between Hope and Scott, maybe given them more to do together.
Who else has sour points?
You guys are dicks.
Like I said from the beginning, all of these are little nitpicky things that they bothered me, but nothing hurt my enjoyment of the movie. This is still probably one of my top five Marvel movies. So I still thought it was a really fun movie.
Right. Well, I'm kind of with you that if they weren't in the movie at all, we'd probably be missing anything. So therefore, I can't really get upset for the very few times they were even on the screen. Maybe they weren't used in the best way. That can't ruin the whole movie for me. You can't say, oh, they didn't use Judy Greer enough for the 5 seconds she was on the screen. Well, then, okay, then she ruined 5 seconds of the movie, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, now sure, maybe you like the actor and you just wish they had a bigger role. That's fine.
That goes to part of my argument that this was more about Hank than it was about Scott, because they did make it clear right in the beginning that his daughter was the most important thing to him, but they didn't have that much time together. I mean, he goes to visit her the night before the heist and he kind of sees her in bed, but I wanted more scenes with him and his daughter. I wanted to see really how important she was to him. And I felt like I was told that she was important to him, but I didn't see it really.
And I have to agree with that. That was actually one of the problems I had with Guardians of the Galaxy, was that they made a big deal about his mom passing away, Peter Quill's mom passing away at the beginning of the movie, and then pretty much nothing throughout the movie aside for his strong affection for the tape deck. And then at the very end, they make a big point of trying to call back to that. And it's so easy to go, oh my God, this kid's mom died. I'm going to hook into this character. It really feels like blatant emotional manipulation in a way that feels artificial and and takes me out of things. And I agree with you that the scenes with his daughter, it was a good actress. I thought that the young actress did a very good job. I honestly think the problem was, to some degree, Paul Rudd. I didn't feel like he was connecting to the girl very well, and the scenes where they're together, I didn't feel like there was a father-daughter thing. It didn't work for me. It felt like that was something that was in the script, but I didn't see it on the screen. I didn't feel it while I was watching the movie.
Well, I think one way they could have made you feel more like, oh man, I really hope Paul Rudd can get his shit together, was to then make the mother and father-in-law dicks, right? Because then you're like, oh gosh, not only because Scott keeps screwing up can he not have custody of his daughter, but she's stuck with this shitty father-in-law. Like, they could have easily just made the father-in-law shitty, and that would have instantly made you have that connection. So I'm kind of glad they didn't cheap out and do that. So because that's the cheap way to do it, right? You make the father-in-law shitty so that you're like, oh, this poor girl is stuck with this asshole. And so I kind of like the way they didn't do that. They made it no. The mom and father-in-law are perfectly good people. They care for the daughter. It's just Paul Rudd keeps screwing up. You know what I mean? Scott Lang's the one that keeps screwing up. That's why he can't get in. And she was even the mother even says she would like for him to get regular custody, but he can't if he keeps going to jail. You know what I mean? So I kind of like that. Unless that relationship took up a larger chunk of the movie, which again I like that the movie wasn't terribly long. So once you start wanting to, I want this develop. I want to see more with Cross. I want him to get developed. I want Hope Van Dyne to get developed with Scott. I want Scott and his daughter to get, well, every time you do that, you got to make the movie longer. You know what I mean? Because you have to have his Avengers interaction. You have to have him training with the ant powers, you know, and then the heist is the culmination of the movie. So, I mean, you know what I mean? I you don't have time to do all that. So they touched on all of it. I thought some of it was pretty effective. Some of it, not so much, but I can't kill the movie over it.
Well, I'm going to disagree with the premise that you have to have the Avengers connection. I could have done without that. I think you needed that at the beginning. I liked that they set up Pym as being connected to Stark, and I love that line too, where it's like, oh yeah, that thing that Tony came up with, that's cute, but this is serious. But
that
I don't
was
think
fantastic.
That, yeah, that was great. But I don't think you needed that whole Falcon sequence, and getting rid of that would have given more room to develop the characters better, I think.
I don't think the Falcon sequence was that long.
Long enough. I mean, given how relative to the scene where he goes and sees his daughter before his big adventure as Ant-Man, it's a pretty big scene.
Okay, sure. Fair enough. I think that they needed some Avengers. I think having some Avengers interaction was fine.
Fix it. You have any bitches?
No.
You have no complaint about this movie at all? Nothing that give you any trouble?
It was a fun movie. I didn't overanalyze it. I just kind of, it was nice little Easter eggs here and there. And it was a fun movie. It like I said, it was shockingly more enjoyable than I thought it'd be.
Do you want to see a sequel?
Pretty much he's going to pop up in what? Civil War. So I guess you could call that a sequel.
Right. But I'm saying, would you actually like to see Ant-Man in a movie, another film?
Not really. I think it's one of those characters, one movie's enough. You don't, I mean, what are they going to have him? Who's he going to find next?
Yeah, we got to have the cinematic view. Egghead. Come on. Was Whirlwind a Ant-Man villain, or was that just the Avengers?
He was, and he had more of a personal vendetta against the Wasp, so that would be interesting to actually make the villain targeting Hope specifically. If they do make a sequel, it has to be called Ant-Man and Wasp.
Correct.
Do we want to see an Ant-Man and Wasp movie?
Not liking that kiss, I don't like this couple as a romantic couple. I don't see that. I don't think their chemistry was particularly great. I mean, if they could work out a way where they're just partners, or if something happens to Hank and they have to buddy up to rescue him, or they work out some other contrivance for them to work together, I'm cool with that. But I don't want to see Scott Lang and Hope Van Dyne get together unless they really do a lot of work to make them to build their chemistry and give them a history together.
Yeah, no, I don't think this movie needs a sequel. Whereas Guardians, you want them to go back. You want to know who Peter Quill's father was, right? Mm-hmm. Like, which is why I think they foreshadowed the mother stuff in Guardians of the Galaxy, because we're going to get back to that at some point. We're going to get back to his father coming to Earth and the origin behind all that. I'm genuinely curious about all that. I'm not really like, I don't really care about where Ant-Man goes from here. But seeing him do the shrinking stuff, I think they could actually incorporate him into the team and it'd be kind of cool. But
I think knowing that Thanos is going to be involved with Guardians 2, I'd really like to see them put some more focus on Gamora and play up what it was like growing up with Nebula and under Thanos. I would like to see that movie. And I like enough of those characters that I would like to see them develop more. I want to see Rocket again. I'd like to see more stuff done with Drax. So I definitely would want to see a Guardians of the Galaxy movie far more than an Ant-Man and Wasp movie.
James Gunn said in his first draft for Guardians Volume 2, the cast of characters, and I'm assuming he means like speaking characters, is smaller than the first one. So I think it will be much more character-centric and focus on the people we already know, and maybe only introducing one or two new elements.
What about you?
I think that would help.
I don't think the Nova Corps is going to be in the second one at all. I don't think we're going to see Glenn Close or John C. Reilly again. I think they did confirm that Nebula will be back, I think.
I think saving Nova Corps for Infinity War.
Yeah, yeah.
But what about you, Fixit?
On what?
Well, both questions, actually. Ant-Man sequel, Ant-Man and Wasp sequel, and Guardians.
I don't think there needs to be a sequel.
So not even with Wasp.
I think they told enough of the story in just this movie. Now, when they add them to the Avengers lore, that'll be good. And what was the other question?
Guardians.
Oh, definitely got to have a sequel. I would like to see them introduce more of the galactic characters in the sequel. Maybe a sighting of Fire Lord or maybe a Skrull in the background. You know, they don't have to be part of the story, but like kind of incorporate those other characters. Because I heard that Starlin had kind of hinted that Warlock will appear in the Infinity War movies.
He is. He's the Vision.
He talked about it.
They can't do Skrulls because that's Fantastic Four, right?
That's right.
Yeah, actually, they have to tread carefully because Fox owns a lot of the cosmic characters too. So,
Watcher in the back, stuff like that would be cool.
Dude, I bet the Watcher and all the Heralds are Fox.
Yeah, Galactus, Silver Surfer, like the Shi'ar Empire, because that's X-Men. I don't think like whatever dumb alien species that they had, the morphs that Ronan was using in this one, they had to use because like they couldn't even use the Badoon, whoever the Badoon is, that's owned by Fox too.
You guys want me to ask my phone what the Badoon is again?
I don't think Count Drunken has made it to the Annihilation episode yet.
I have actually, I listened to that one.
Okay.
So what's left in terms of galactic characters that they could use in the Marvel movie?
Quasar, Mar-Vell.
How about Ego?
Ego the Living Planet, I think they can, and I would fucking love to see that.
Ego is weird, dude.
See Ego the Living Planet, that would be awesome.
Ego and Epoch, right?
Like yeah, Epoch came out of Mar-Vell as well, so that shouldn't be an issue.
Captain Mar-Vell, of course.
Yeah, well, the great thing about Captain Mar-Vell is that ultimately he descends from Marvel Boy, which nobody ever bothered to license, so he's safe, and all of his descendants are safe. I want to see another talking tree. They could probably even tie Epoch into Groot somehow.
That could get done. I could do that. I could write that movie right now.
But yeah, like I mean, in terms of like the Annihilation event that you guys were just reading, half of the characters and concepts in that are tied up by Fox. The Negative Zone, the Annihilus himself, Super
Blastar,
Skrulls.
Probably Blastar.
Blastar probably is Fox, because, I mean, it's strange that somehow Marvel does have the Kree, even though the Kree came out of Fantastic Four, but...
I'm wondering if 50 is the demarcation point on the Fantastic Four properties, like, because that seems like the Inhumans came after 50, I think. Certainly, Black Panther came after 50.
Right after 50. He came out like 52.
Right, so that's what I'm saying, and I think that 50 must be the break point, because they're playing with a ton of stuff that came right after 50, but everything from 50 down seems like it's untouchable, including the freaking Rama Tut, whatever the hell that guy's name was. They screws up Kang for now.
No Mole Man, you're saying?
Nope, no Mole Man, definitely not.
No, Mole Man is in the Fantastic Four movie. They cast the ultimate Fantastic Four version of that guy.
Oh, for real?
Is that the
Tim Blake Nelson?
Right. So
he's like, I think his name is like Dr. Malekovich or something. That's the ultimate version of Mole Man.
Now, here's the thing, though. I'm pretty confident we're not going to actually see Mole Man, though, right? Is this another one of those situations where he got cast as the leader in the Hulk movie and then nothing came of that?
And they'll set it up at the end. He'll fall down into a giant pit and he'll wake up surrounded by moloids or something, and we'll never get a sequel to this movie. I am actively hoping that movie fails and that it's just put away. I, as a Fantastic Four fan, I do not want to see the movie or anything come of it.
People hate this movie, mm-hmm. for real. Like lots of people don't want anything to do with this movie. And what's really, and a lot of it has to do with because Johnny Storm is now black because people are racist.
That's the least of my problems with the casting. Like that was the one thing I was like, I don't care about that. I have a much bigger problem with Kate Mara as Sue Storm.
Oh, she's okay. She's the one person whenever I see her on the street, I'm like, she looks sick, doesn't she?
That's another wig too, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty confident about that. Yeah, and she's she seems. I don't know. I still prefer her over Jessica Alba, though.
Well, Jessica Alba, that's what I'm saying. Nobody had a problem with Sue Storm's not supposed to be Hispanic. Nobody cared.
Actually, John Byrne specifically had a problem with that.
Did he for real?
Yeah, he said he thinks that Latinas with blonde hair look cheap.
Oh my God. Hey, shout out to John Byrne.
But when I see Kate Mara, she's like, I think that she's going to peel her skin off and it's just going to be spiders crawling out. Like, something about her just grosses me out. I don't know.
Yeah, she, like I said, she looks sick. She looks like they're emaciated. So.
And the thing is, at this point, I don't even... I would like Marvel Studios to get the rights back to the Fantastic Four, but I don't know what they would do with it because... the characters in the comics, they're the elder statesmen. They are the first family. They sort of bequeathed these legends and these powers to the rest of the universe, and they were sort of looked up at. And now, if you introduce them after the Avengers have been around for 5 years, it's I don't know what the point of bringing them into the Marvel universe is now. So I just want the property to be put in a box and forgotten for a decade.
My question I'm wondering about, you know how Fox had Daredevil, and then pretty quickly they managed to turn around and make that a TV series. But there's majorly different rules from TV series to movies. I'm wondering if there's some sort of a non-compete thing where they can't make a Fantastic Four movie, where maybe they would have to go in a different medium to do that, to deal with that. It's just like Namor and Hulk, they're not going to get movies because Universal still has ties to those characters, even if they...
Well, Universal has the distribution rights.
Right,
like,
that's what
Marvel
I'm saying.
Marvel can make a Hulk movie, but they have to pay Universal to put it in theaters.
Exactly. So they don't need to do that. They don't want to do that. They'd rather go a different way. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't have that same sort of situation with the Fantastic Four, even if they did come back.
Maybe.
Possible.
And you can't do Fantastic Four as a TV show. The budget just that... Fantastic Four needs scope. That needs to be huge.
Well, that's the thing, though, is you can make a movie that doesn't call the Fantastic Four that involves those characters, though. Those could be like the big... Like, you have the Avengers movies, and I kind of would like for them to start making movies just about the team and not so much having to build the entire Marvel Universe out of the Avengers movies. I'd like for them to kind of settle in and let's just deal with this group of characters. And then you could do a Marvel Universe movie, like a crossover, like an event, and let that be its own thing. And then when you have tons of characters getting thrown at you, it's not detracting from the title character.
Nah, I can't do that. Too many characters.
No, I think you want a proper Avengers 3, and you want Infinity War to be Marvel Studios Infinity War, not Avengers.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying.
It probably will be anyway, because they're probably going to throw in Spider-Man and the Guardians of the Galaxy into those movies too. So
can I just say too, I was at Target today, and you know how they've been pushing the Marvel shirts, and they'd like to do the little stock art and such. And so I'm looking at this shirt, and it's got the guys we're used to now. You got your Hulk, you got your Cap, you got your Thor, and then all of a sudden right up front, here's Spider-Man slinging right at you, blocking the other characters. And that was such a great metaphor and made me so angry at the same time. I just feel like that's going to happen.
Yeah, I've expressed my concern over this a million times. I hate Spider-Man. I hate that idiot, stupid butthole, and I wish that his face would stop farting. Sorry, I had to tone that down for the kids.
Not a problem.
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that Taste forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at...
the departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
The Kree-Skrull War.
The arrival of Marvel Team-Up.
Bill Murray as the Human Torch.
Creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne.
And of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
I'm just going to get it out of the way real quick. I'm going to be the buzzkill. I think this is among the worst of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, in competition with the Thors for me, particularly Thor 2. Kind of enjoyed about half of it, and then by the halfway point, I was really checking out on the movie. So I didn't want to kill the buzz, and I didn't want to pull a Guardians where it's like, oh, by the way, Gamora ruins it, and blah, 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 blah. But yeah, I really didn't enjoy the movie that much. I liked it okay. I'm hoping I'll like it better on repeats, but for the first run, I just wasn't that into it.
What were the points, like what made you start to check out at the halfway point?
The exact point is when Scott is falling from Antony, and they never go back and explain that. It reminded me, we all saw Resident Evil when it came out, and there's a sequence where all the zombies are crowding in on the heroes, and then there's a cut, and then all of a sudden Michelle Rodriguez is dripping blood at the zombies, and they're up at safety. And that was something that both my buddies had real issues with, because they're like, well, how the fuck did that happen? For me, I needed them to explain, okay, he falls, and then all of a sudden he's in this bed again, and it was this kind of cheap transition. exposition. And that's when I first started checking out, because stuff like that kept happening. Not so much continuity issues. Mac made a good point where they make a point of, okay, he stole this thing from the New Avengers base, so they're going to show it in one quick cut to show that it was part of the necessary equipment for the break-in. It wasn't just bullshit. They were real good about tidying up most of that type of stuff. But I started thinking about how this movie felt kind of funky. And what I started thinking about was AI, how Steven Spielberg directs this Stanley Kubrick movie, and it doesn't feel like Spielberg, and it doesn't feel like Kubrick. It feels like this thing that just doesn't fit in either one of their worlds, and it like this compromised movie. And that's how this felt to me, because I could see those Edgar Wright touches, and then it became like this kind of lame sitcomedy kind of thing. All the stuff with Scott hanging out with his family, I was hating that. I hated his cast of characters that were helping him out. I really have issues with race in this movie, because you got the black hero who gets thrown under the bus to make Scott Lang look good. You've got the Latino character, the first prominent Hispanic in a Marvel movie, and he's this kind of goofy guy who's can't stay on subject, and he's a career criminal, and you got the two other guys that are barely there, but they're there just enough to kind of irritate you. And meanwhile, you've got the white guy who's the straight superhero kind of guy. And it bothered me because it's like they make this big deal about how he's supposed to have been this guy who tried to fight the system. And, he's supposed to be a master's in electrical engineering. So how did he get to be such a good fucking burglar? Was that like after he did that one big heist? Because the thing is, you can get a job as an ex-con. I've worked with plenty of ex-cons, and it wasn't at fucking Baskin Robbins. So it's not like he was really forcing that life. So this is a guy who already has a kid, and he decides to stick it to the man because he can't let that stuff go. So he loses his kid because he's a fucking idiot. And this is a guy who's supposed to be educated. And I've heard the Marvel movies called competency porn sometimes, where all their heroes have to be like extremely accomplished. None of them can be an everyman. And as much as they're trying to play him as an everyman, he's a fucking master's in electrical engineering. So he's not a fucking everyman, and he doesn't work in that respect. And I've seen enough Paul Rudd movies. I know his persona, and it seemed like he was trying his best to play more of a hero. But to me, he just was a nothing. He sort of disappears in the movie. I think almost every other character in the movie is more interesting than him. It's one of the reasons why I'd much rather see the Wasp than anything else with Scott Lang. I didn't think any of the characters interacted well with each other. It felt like the entire movie was done on a green screen, and the actors were doing their isolated performances. And I think that individual actors were pretty solid in what they were trying to do. But as far as how they related to one another on the screen, I felt like they were all disconnected from one another. I didn't feel like any of them like were really talking to each other very well. I didn't like the CGI stuff with the ants. I got bored with that. They've been running Honey, I Shrunk the Kids on cable recently. And of course, that's all like physical props that these guys are interacting with. And I enjoy that so much more than watching the CGI stuff. I always check out when it's just, here's a bunch of CGI ants. Nothing on the screen is real. It's all animated, and it just doesn't do anything for me. Again, I talked about the limp emotional manipulation. I didn't like that. I didn't find the action interesting. It felt to me like remember they did the proof of concept footage that Edgar Wright did that really got you excited for it. And the best action sequence in this movie was them repeating slavishly that, and I didn't feel like they added anything to it. I don't think that they had like a real vision. I think they were just doing their best to kind of do the script as best as they could while still packing in all this Marvel Universe shit. That some of it I loved. Again, I love that opening sequence with that was set in 89, but like going to the Avengers compound and constantly referencing the Avengers, after a while it started to kind of rub me the wrong way. And the whole movie felt like a 90s superhero movie to me. It felt like they were trying to recreate those movies, and I didn't really love 90s superhero movies. Those were movies that were trying to figure out how to do a superhero movie, and by it feeling like this is an homage to that, it just felt like all the stuff that kind of didn't like about those type of movies were present in this movie. So to me, I'm watching it and it feels very Disney-fied. It feels very family friendly. It feels like, obviously this movie isn't made for me, and I really feel like it's being made for the regular people. I think this is the kind of like one of those summer babysit the kids kind of movies, and I think that you're probably going to see more Marvel movies go that way, where I kind of want to see a movie where they're willing to go dark. I want to see the movie where Hank Pym is slapping his wife and all this kind of darker stuff is happening. And I think I'm going to get that at Fox with stuff like Deadpool. I think I'm going to get it at Warner Brothers with stuff like Suicide Squad, where they're going to have more versatility. They're going to have ability to go to places where Marvel isn't going to be willing to, because they're going to start selling me the toys. They're not going to sell me the movies that I want to see as an adult and as a lifelong comic reader. And I get that those movies aren't made for me, but at the same time, I'm not going to run around championing them if they're going to just keep selling me the Pixar movie in superhero form.
I didn't get this as a babysit your kids movie in the slightest, like at all. Especially, and the trailers didn't set this up as a, hey, bring your kids, check out all this shrunken stuff. I didn't think I didn't get that at all. I mean, I understand. I mean, if you felt that way, that's cool. I don't think this movie's going to make $1 billion. This movie's going to, like, I think they're projecting to do maybe 60 million this weekend. I think this will definitely be the least successful of the Marvel movies. I don't know what they internally thought this movie was going to do, but I felt we would have seen tons of the CGI ant stuff in the trailers if they were really going to direct this towards kids to get kids in here. And I thought that some of the themes through the movie, though they weren't like explicit, were still, you know, these guys were criminals doing crimes.
They were wacky criminals doing wacky crimes.
Yeah, but I
agree to the point that, I mean, for being criminals and ex-cons, it was really toned down. Like, this was more like Sneakers. This was non-violent crimes with, yeah.
Well, they were burgles.
Right. That was actually something that I did want. I wanted to see a little bit more of what would make Scott decide, because they mentioned almost in passing how he committed this very sort of Robin Hood like burgle of this VistaCorp to give the money back to the people. And I really wanted to see what was his process. Like, what was he like before he went to jail?
I think he was a dick. I think he was cocky, and I think he thought he was going to get away with it, and he lost his kid because of it, and good for them, because that was bullshit. And when you're a father, you shouldn't be doing that kind of shit. Sorry.
No,
all right.
That's why I saved it for the back end of the podcast.
Yeah, dude. I think that you're, I'm starting to think that you're expecting way too much out of these movies, man.
You're harshing my mellow.
You're harshing everybody's mellow.
No, but I mean, that's why the first thing I said was I judge the Marvel Studios movies based on the amount of fan service they give me. Because I still think the best made Marvel movie, I still think I go back to the first Iron Man. There isn't an ounce of fat on that. That is just slick and tight and funny. But Iron Man wasn't my favorite one of these characters. So I like seeing Captain America a little bit more. I like seeing Ant-Man a little bit more. And yeah, so for them to be able to give me a movie that was this fun despite the flaws, I give it a major props for that.
Let's see if I was making another point. Damn it. Shit. I lost it. Fuck. Okay. Somebody else talk. Oh, wait. Hold on. So wait. What do you think about the stinger?
The post-credits one? The last one?
Yeah.
Like as I understand it, that was just a scene from Civil War. It's like, it was in the dailies and Kevin Feige was looking at it and is like, that would be a good little scene to throw at the end of Ant-Man.
They hadn't thrown a serious stinger at us in a while, though, right?
No.
Like we had Howard the Duck, Age of Ultron didn't really have anything. So I was expecting some kooky, wacky bit with him shrunken down or something. Not a scene from,
Civil War.
I was like, oh, yeah. Shit, was not expecting that.
And it's weird because we don't have context for it. So, I mean, it's...
If you're a comic fan, you do, because, you know, gone south.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's obviously from Falcon's line, this would have been a lot easier a week ago. It sounds like whatever the major event is that divides these people, that has already happened.
I like that they do mention that after the Accord. So, you know, okay, this is some kind of an international crackdown.
Mm-hmm.
So right, I like that it's bigger than just the states. It's like, oh, the entire world is having issues with us. And rightfully so. That's one thing that's kind of cool about Avengers 2 versus Man of Steel is the next Batman Superman movie is going to be dealing with the fallout from Man of Steel. But you're kind of going to that movie already with an axe to grind against Superman and the Man of Steel. Avengers 2 does a good job of making sure you're on the side of the heroes. But at the same time, they unleashed Ultron. That's a big freaking deal. And you could see Iron Man being on the wrong side of that accord because he's the guy responsible for creating Ultron in the first place. So it makes internal sense. I like that they did a much better job of setting that up at Marvel than DC.
Mm-hmm. So you want me to tell you the story of my life?
He was the only survivor of the accident.
Do you mind telling me who the Masked Man is?
And you have no idea who I am, do you?
Has he said anything about what happened?
I'll tell you my story. I'll tell you all of it.
You know, is my daddy and what does he do? I know who I am.
The Secret Origins Podcast, a review show dedicated to the post-crisis Secret Origins series published by DC Comics. Join me, Ryan Daly, and an all-star assembly of guests to reveal the untold origin stories of DC Comics' most legendary characters, as well as Kong Gorilla.
Ant-Man would have been a better DIY Iron Man. Like, if they'd done what they did in Iron Man 3 for Ant-Man, that could have worked a lot better. Going to Home Depot and putting together his little suit and shit, which he kind of did with the safe-cracking sequence.
Okay, getting back to Ant-Man, since Frank revisited it, when I saw it the second time with a buddy of mine, and he brought up the question that, would this movie have been better if it had come out before the Avengers? If this had been a Phase 1 Marvel movie? Because, I mean, it's been a while since we've seen, like, an origin movie, and this was sort of an origin movie. It was a legacy movie, but for all intents and purposes, we were getting a lot of the same origin story beats.
There was a training montage. It's an origin story.
Right. Would this movie have just been more enjoyable? Does it, and I hate to use this pun, but did the story seem too small after we've seen the Avengers movies?
I read some reviews and there are a lot of people who are applauding it. Look, you can do a superhero movie. It doesn't have to be world-saving stakes. I completely agree with that. I want to see more small movies. No pun intended. And a lot of the fucking articles had to do the same fucking thing. We don't mean it like that. We're not trying to be funny. It's not about the stakes. It's just, I think it needs to be in the place where it's at, because this movie to some degree feels like the internet helped to write it, because that stinger with Wasp, that's the internet. They were talking directly to Twitter with that first stinger. I think that this was a movie where they were trying to do a mulligan. Look, we've got the wasp is going to be awesome, here's your pseudo origin for the Wasp as well. So I don't think so. And honestly though, I have to say, I don't feel like this is a Phase 2 movie. I think this is a bridge between Phase 2 and Phase 3, whether it actually fits into Phase 3 or it's just this bridging thing, this coda to Phase 2, but it doesn't feel like it's really a part of Phase 2 to me either.
Because the bar's been kind of set high with these movies, I think if this movie would have come out, say, just after Iron Man 1 or 2, I think people would be freaking out about how good it is.
I think it's too similar to Iron Man, though, for it to come that close to them. I think that this is sort
very
of a replacement.
It's very similar to Iron Man 1. Very similar. Mm-hmm. I mean, Obadiah Stane, Cross is trying to be Obadiah Stane, right?
Well, that's one of my concerns about Doctor Strange, is Doctor Strange's origin is very similar to Tony Stark's, except it's trading technology for magic. I'm concerned about what that movie is going to be
but it's
in
not
terms
be
story structure.
It's not going to be an origin story, though. They've come right out and said they're not going
to
do an origin story.
I mean, they will have to explain it, but yeah.
No, you don't have to explain it, though. I mean, we've got a Doctor Strange origin story in the can. It's already recorded. It's been recorded for a while now. I haven't edited it yet because it's too fucking hours. But they've already come out and said they're not going to do an origin story. You can have him show up. He's a mystic superhero, and he's immediately on the case like Sherlock Holmes. You don't have to do an origin story. And my understanding is Marvel does not want to do another origin story. So I don't think you're going to get that at all. I think that's one thing that might be to the movie's benefit, besides the fact they're obviously casting far against type. They're casting way away from the comic books themselves. But I think they're just going to do, like, however you pronounce it, mise-en-scene or whatever. They're just going to start it up without any kind of
in medias res.
There you go. Thank you.
Whoa, you got franked.
Yep. I felt it.
I like all the actors they've cast in it that I've heard so far. I just don't know if I'm going to like them in these particular parts.
I guarantee I'm not going to. I'm already well, not looking forward to watching this movie at all. We'll have a whole episode of me bitching. So
I look forward to that one. I look forward to the Batman Superman podcast is going to be the greatest podcast we've ever done.
I think
it's gonna literally. The kids use what's called Periscope now, which is basically where you're like a live streaming video.
Okay.
I'm gonna have a tight crop of Diablo Frank's nose as it starts bleeding as he's just screaming and yelling the whole time. Like, you thought his Superman rant in that last podcast we did was bad. You just wait.
We'll just edit in the Hitler scene from Downfall that everybody memed out.
Oh yeah, that's good.
I'm stealing.
Yeah.
I feel like we've already made that episode. I don't think we have to actually record a Batman vs. Superman episode. We've touched on that so goddamn much. We've touched on it more than the Duggars touched on his sisters. It's too much.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm signing off after that one, guys. What a better way to end a Marvel Superheroes podcast recording session than a freaking Duggars fondling joke. You people are disgusting.
Let's try to have a name.
I actually forgot why we were all talking. I forgot what we were doing.
Oh, the movies, the top 104
movies.
Welcome
to our world.
Yeah, this is what happens every time. Oh, my God. You're terrible
people. It gets worse.
Terrible people.
It gets so much worse.
Hey, listeners, it's Ryan Daly here to give you an exciting sneak peek at the Secret Origins podcast, a review show dedicated to the post-crisis Secret Origins comics. Secret Origins told or retold or occasionally reimagined the origins of many of DC's legendary superheroes, including Superman, Batman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Jonah Hex, Nightwing, Plastic Man, Batgirl, Blackhawk, Black Lightning, Booster Gold, Detective Chimp, the Legion of Superheroes, and 100 others. But I won't be alone in my coverage of these epic stories. I'm bringing the best and brightest and irredeemablest guest stars from the blogosphere and podcast community, such as Chris Franklin from the Supermates podcast.
I think this is a great idea for a podcast, and I wish I thought of it first, but it's in good hands.
Chris and I are going to be reviewing the first issue of Secret Origins, which tells the story of the Golden Age Superman. And now, Chris, I don't know if this has ever come up before on your own show, but would you say you're much of a Superman fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am definitely a Superman fan. Superman, the movie, is still my favorite movie of all time. That's my Star Wars. I don't remember a time when I didn't know who Superman was.
Tim Wallace from Cord Industries, a blog devoted to Blue Beetle.
My friends, my close friends, would probably tell you that Aquaman was my favorite hero, and they wouldn't be too far off from the truth, but there was already a pretty decent blog covering Aquaman, so I went for my number two, which was Blue Beetle. And this issue actually has a lot to do with why he's one of my favorites.
Luke Giaconetti from the Hawkman blog Being Carter Hall in the Earth Destruction Directive podcast. Thank you for having the enthusiasm to talk about Halo, because this is not a character that I know much about.
I'm one of the oddballs in that I'm an Outsiders fan who doesn't like the Teen Titans. So I figure I'm pretty much required to do my due diligence in defending the members of the Outsiders team, especially one of the originals.
Siskoid from Siskoid's blog of Geekery and the Hero Points podcast.
One of the subjects I keep returning to is Golden Age superheroes. I like exploring the history of comics, and especially DC Comics, which has the biggest load of Golden Age heroes. In Secret Origins is full of these, because Roy Thomas wrote half the series or so, and just like he wrote a lot of Golden Age heroes and brought Golden Age heroes to the to our attention in the 80s, which was when I started reading comics.
And of course, Rob Kelly from the Fire and Water podcast.
The plan was, all this time, once we finished Who's Who, we were going to do the Secret Origin series. That was our next big project. And you have swooped in and stolen it. And I'm just saying, you better not screw this up. I mean, you're on episode 4 and you brought in your biggest guest star yet. But from here, if it's just downhill, I'm going to be really ticked off that you ruined our idea.
I wasn't really listening to any of that. Plus more incredible guests, including Sean Engel, Chad Bokelman, Kyle Benning, Nathaniel Wayne, Paul Scavito, Greg Araujo, Tom Panarese, Doug Zawissa, Aaron Moss, Alan Middleton, Max Romero, Gene Hendricks, Stella, Ange, Diablo Frank, and possibly even more. Join us as we uncover the secret origins of all your favorite DC heroes, except for Wonder Woman, and Aquaman, and Supergirl, and the Huntress, and Red Tornado, and Mira, and Aqualad, and Jon Stewart, the Green Lantern, and Wildcat, and Metamorpho, and Geo-Force, and Mr. Terrific, and Snap. The Secret Origins Podcast.
We received Google Plus ones on two recent episodes from Keith G. Baker and Vic Sage, or Zaz if you read the Denny O'Neill series. We have new Twitter followers, The Three Cuckoos Podcast, 80s Reboot Overdrive, Agent at Superhero Agents, Alexander Alvarez, Amish Baby Machine, Encore, Batman Dark Knight, BBL at Blubber Co., Blood and Gourd, Borja Obeso, Cassandra Oceano, Collector's Den, Comic Relief Podcast, The Comics World, Cyber Elf, Dan, Artist, 34, at Planet Dan, The Dark Angels and Pretty Freaks Podcast, and The Dark Angels and Pretty Freaks Podcast's Neil C., Darth Vader Number 1, trademark, David at It Is Davey, Dead as Hell, Dr. Darcy Sterling, Downfall 2012, Drunken Dork Podcast, EB2B underscore Cloud, Elena Anchova, Emiliano Correa, Fear Inez or Fear Inns at The Fear Agenda, Flickering Myth, Foot Pound Force, Gareth Hampton, Graphic Novice, Hamster City Comic, Hero Rundown, Hilton Ariel Ruiz, Horror Mansion, Instagrants 2, Jack Dark, James Cullen Bresak, Jeanne Jones, John Mellon, Karen at Kazzy 69, Christo 2814, League of One, The Lo-Fi Show, Mary at Audio Bible 5008, Men's Forum, spelled with a Z, Michael Sakel, Mr. Mallet, Nikita at Miss Nikita Quinn, Nikki at EatKS, Omnis For It, Paul Vandervoort, The Phantom at Kit the Phantom, Thatopus Comics, Promote Horror, Quotes Darth Vader, Renee at Elephantagoru, Retro Toys at Reaction Figure, Salty Language Podcast, Self-Destruct Comics, Shadowbox Comics, Sinead Barkley, Space Chief 75, Steve Whistler, The Stranger Conversations Podcast, really, The Superhero Method, Swiftwater Stew, T-Message Quotes, T-D-O-S-L-W-H, Terror Troop, Tim Mason at Regeekin, Timothy Robertson, Tony Greenell, Waiting for Doom Podcast, related to the Doom Patrol, Wayward Raven, World of Drobe at The Jabbercrow, and Zombie with a Shotgun. Twitter favorites came from Adam Blackmoon, After the Gold Rush, Al Mega First Crusader, Amy Royland, Anthony Durso, Baked English Podcast, Ben Cohen, C. Miller, Charles Washington, Chris Perry, Chris Thompson, City War, Comic Book Lion, Comical Podcast, Couple Things Podcast, David Fior, David Galayer of the High Moon graphic novel, David Golding Artist, Dead as Hell, Derek Hyde, Dobbs at Chasing Horses, Ed Moore at Teal Productions, Elijah Medge, Eric Mannix, Fear Ends, Firestorm Fan, Foot Pound Force, Hailstorm Comics, J.D. Barker, Jonathan Mayberry, writer will be at Space City Comic Con this weekend, Joseph Crawford, Larry W. Looper Jr., Longbox Graveyard, Luis Mendez Aleo, Mark Sweeney, Missing Politic, Nikki at EatKS, or that's actually everything but the kitchen sink, I believe, Out of the Fridge, Orbital Comics, Patch of Land, Philip Thomas, Plop Cartoons, Professor Riptide, Rachel Boomtown, Rally Crowd TV, Sketch Comedy Podcast, Space Case Comic, Super Podcasto, Titanium Comics, Woofda, Vultures, Wednesday Comics, and Wetsuit at Lucid Cadet. Retweets coming from BS Podcast Network, Comic Tweets, Keith G. Baker, and Readers Group at Streatham Comics.
We got Follow Fridays and Other Assorted Weekdays from Adam Blackmoon, Odell Abner Dracula, Superhero Speak, and Titanium Comics. Martin Gray at Two Strangers for a Girl blog wrote of the Amazing Heroes Interviews Peter David episode. I liked Eric Larson's Aquaman. It was good to get away from super tetchy Arthur, but the Dan Juergens, Steve Epting run rules. And when we were discussing Joe Biscopo, he mentioned, it's funny how SNL never got a regular UK transmission. He was also perfectly happy to see Monty Python exported out of his country, so to each his own. Dead as Hell let us know that he was downloading our first episode. Wondered if, do you guys really talk that fast? Sounds weird. Listening makes me feel as ignorant as that time I tried to play the Marvel Comics Scene It. Odell Abner Dracula wrote, the only podcast I've ever heard talk about Dr. Zero, which prompted Ram Tower to write, Shadowline was the best. Charlton Hero wrote, I would love to hear that Dune podcast on the film comics adaptation by Marvel. That would be comedy gold. Ange wrote, just watch the first Ghost Rider movie while ironing shirts. Hell on Earth? Anyways, would love a Ghost Rider episode. CJ wrote of episode 41, Rolled Spine Premature Birthday Self-Congratulations Summer Special. Congrats on the year anniversary, great app all around. Kyle Binning wrote of the same episode, listening to the Marvel Superheroes podcast and I am laughing my ass off at Mac talking about cosplayers. Jason Martinez let us know that he was listening to episode 42, Annihilation 2006. Drunken Dork podcast tweeted related to our discussion of Wonder Woman and the Earth One graphic novel, if I recall correctly. That's what's so great about classic characters. They're open to interpretation. I love the name of your podcast. We'll definitely be checking this show out and recommending it to folks. Cal Druncula wrote, just watched Ant-Man last night, so I'm still processing the good, bad, and meh of that. A whole year to get through six episodes of Annihilation coverage. MSH is the podcast equivalent of Brian Hitch on Ultimates 2 or John Cassidy on Astonishing X-Men. Slow but pretty, probably award caliber. And they left a comment on our blog. One of my main fantasy projects, if I ever worked for Marvel, would be an Annihilation-style event based on Marvel's horror characters. Set it up with a prelude miniseries starring Doctor Strange and Damon Hellstrom. Then miniseries starring the original Legion of Monsters, Ghost Rider, Morbius, Man-Thing, and Werewolf by Night. Before culminating in a massive supernatural epic with appearances by Dracula, Manfibian, Simon Garth, Monster Frankenstein, Satana, Blade, and the Night Stalkers. Oh well. I don't remember if it was this episode or last one where Max said Vision is the Adam Warlock of the MCU, but it makes perfect sense. Now I'm curious where Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 will go. Fingers crossed for Ego the Living Planet. And considering he wrote that before we recorded the episode that you just heard, it's sort of an Ouroboros of commentary going on here. I would buy the shit out of the Legion of Monsters crossover epic. The Legion of Monsters issue of, I think, Marvel Showcase was one of the first comics I ever got at a flea market. So I have a soft spot for that particular teaming of Bronze Age goodness. And by the way, Martin Gray, when we do get around to the J.M. DeMatteis episode of Amazing Heroes Interviews, you may be happy to know that Damon Hellstrom comes up quite a bit. Check out the blog to see a piece of art featuring the Christopher Reeve Superman tweeted to us by Timothy Robertson. And Kyle Binning also showed us what he picked up while visiting our hometown, Houston, from local comic shop Bedrock City. And you can also watch the Sexy Sax Man. This week's Mary Marvel Marching Society consists of Angel Velasquez, Ange, Ask the Moon, Bradley J. Tim, Charlton Hero, Chris William, CJ, Count Druncula, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Dead Vinyl, Eli at Eelperrin, Eternal Rage, Fantastiverse, Film Reel Podcast, The First Bat, Future Primitive, Hall of Justice, Kanish Kabbalah, Chord Industries, Land of the Creeps, Lizzo, Marvel Incorporated, Miss Moneypenny, My Star Wars Story, Nergasmo, Odell Abner Dracula, Odyssey Unleashed Podcast, Outside Longbox, Party Roll Podcast, The Penultimate, Pittsburgh Nerd Pod, Randy Caldwell, Richard Calvert, Siskoid, Senate Alias Scarecrow, Tanya Malone, Trekker Talk Podcast, and Universal Radio.
The Marvel Superheroes Podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
I'm still getting a lot of perv breathing from your new setup, dude.
Just who, me?
Yeah, you might want to like dial back the gain a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I can actually do that.
Yeah, because you're kind of turning me on right now, and I'm uncomfortable with that.
Oh, welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. Let's throw on some more Careless Whisper.
That intro went for highs and high. The highs were high and the lows were low. I don't know what you guys did in that intro to that episode.
I think what happened is I went to go get something to drink and they were just screwing around because we'd watched that Sax Man video.
Sexy Sax Man. Have you ever seen Sexy Sax Man, Ryan?
I knew the tune, but I haven't. I haven't seen that.
So that's the song "Careless Whisper." It's a George Michael song.
Yeah.
So there's a guy named the Sexy Sax Man, and you pay him money, and he comes out with no shirt, and he only knows one song. And
don't forget the rat tail.
And the rat tail. So if you go to YouTube, and search "Sexy Sax Man," and there's a great video from it. So I had just shown them this video. It's super old, but. But so that was kind of in our heads when we started recording. It was bad.
He just turns up and gets thrown out of places. He goes to like a college lecture. He's at the mall and security are trying to throw him out. And he's just this random scrawny dude who does this crap.
I couldn't remember the name of the song. I was like, is that George Michael or NXS? Yeah. That was bothering me. But
technically, it's Wham. I just have to point that out.
Wham track?
My sisters were really into Wham. And I remember hearing that on the Wham album.
So pre George Michael solo.
Correct. Pre Faith, which is a great album, by the way. Are you agreeing or just humoring me?
No, I have a few songs from that album that I got on iTunes that I actually listened to. I love the song Freedom, actually. That's one of my favorite music videos and a grid.
Oh, pop song. The original version, not Freedom 90.
Both versions.
Okay.
Hey, can you still hear my heavy breathing?
No, you did dial it back, thank God.
I actually kind of miss it.
I know. Edit that back in later. I need you to put my heavy breathing on a soundboard. Mr. Fix It. If this works, it's going to be pretty awesome.
I think so. It'll be fun. Because that's the thing is, Druncula is our Hank Pym expert. He's
well.
The closest we're ever going to get.
Okay.
Look. The definition of expert on this podcast is real loose, so
yeah,
it's all good. Oh, that is stuck in my head now, freaking for the rest of the night.
We could sing Father Figure to you. Would that help?
What is Father Figure?
I am not your father, or I will be your father figure. Put your tiny hand in mine. I will be your preacher, teacher.
That song.
Yeah, that one.
That song.
Hey, you know what? That chick had the same haircut as Hope Van Dyne in that video. You remember the video?
Save it for the podcast.
Shh.
Okay.
Yeah, we're actually. So I want to try this again to finish it up, huh?
What are we doing?
Well, we're going to do Ant-Man.
Train wreck any good?
Yeah, I think y'all dig it.
Cool.
Because you're seeing it with the lady, right? Your lady?
A sexy lady.
Yeah, y'all seeing it together, right?
Wait a minute. Well, we're definitely talking about Ant-Man, right?
No, yeah, that's what the podcast is about. But since you happen to bring up Train Wreck, I'm asking you if you and the lady you go to sleep with are going to go see that fucking movie tomorrow, like you said you were going to.
Tomorrow.
Okay, good.
Tomorrow.
So you will go see it.
I just wanted to make sure it's worth it.
Yeah. No, it's definitely enjoyable. I think that she'll probably end up liking it better than you, just like what happened with me and mine when we saw it. It plays well to the ladies, I think, better than the guys, but still good for the guys too. It's not like a chick flick or anything, but there's definitely some strong dramedy elements in there. There's definitely that whole what's his fuck face, the director,
LeBron James,
Judd Apatow. It's definitely got that Judd Apatow let's get serious for about 20 minutes thing going on. So there is that, but it is real funny, and it's a fun movie. I'm just sick of people saying that LeBron James is the real star of the show, because that's the same kind of fucking bullshit. He's in the movie probably total of about 10 minutes. He is good in it. It's not his fucking movie. And when people fucking say that shit, it's like, this is the problem we have. We got a good movie here. We got a good actress. We got good actors. And you're trying to say that this one guy steals the whole fucking show. He's just had a nice little bit player. Give me a fucking break. Just irritates me. So just have
that. It's because he's the most famous person in the movie.
Yeah, I get it. Well, Amy Schumer's having a great year, though.
LeBron James is 3 trillion times more famous than Amy Schumer.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that. And he does do a good job as a comedic actor. This is a guy who's already setting up his post-game career.
So it's LeBron James' movie.
No, it's not, you motherfucker.
That's what I heard.
His career is a train wreck, so.
He doesn't even have the best stuff in the movie. He's got some good stuff, but it's not the best stuff in the movie. Schumer is the best person in the movie in terms of comedy. So don't just, you know.